Give us one. How you doing?
Oh,
it hurts.
I
wouldn't have believed we're going to get out work.
Good morning. Happy spring. All right. So we're calling to order the Tuesday, March 26th meeting of the Story County Board of Supervisors. If you'll please, those of you who care to stand and join us as we say the Pledge of Allegiance.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Next up on our agenda is public comment number one. This is for items on the agenda today. If you're not able to stay for the entire meeting and you'd like to make a comment now, or you can come up and make an announcement or a comment on anything else that you're interested in. I don't see anyone standing up to come up to the microphone, so we're going to move now to the next item. As soon as my agenda opens. And we're going to welcome Raising Readers this morning for their annual report. Lisa Ryu, who I met. Okay. And Lisa, I'll have you introduce your guest.
All right.
And Dan, just please tell us about Raising Readers.
This is Autumn Long. She is our data specialist. And Shelley Orngard, she is our board president. So thank you for having us today. Literacy is not just fundamental. It is an essential skill. Research shows that children who are exposed to books and read to each day become better readers and are more successful in school than children that don't have the same advantage. Raising Readers has 11 programs that we report on to the Board of Supervisors. I will highlight some of those programs for you today. In the Thrive by Five category, Reach Out and Read is a program where we give books at well child checkups for children 6 months to 5 years. Raising Readers provides over 10,000 books a year for that program. For preschoolers, we have two programs that provide literacy support for 113 children. They are Story Pals in Zeering, Nevada, and Ames schools, and then the Preschool Reading Buddies at the ACPC Center. Super K, last year we had a total of 38 students that in Nevada and in Ames that participated in the Super K program, and it helps prepare children for the transition to kindergarten. For the coming summer so far, we already have 30 students that are registered for the program. Out of school learning category, the Harrison Barnes Reading Academy Summer Reading Buddies program provides literacy support for children one-on-one that have completed kindergarten through third grade. Last year, we provided literacy support for 136 students with 120 volunteers. We had a site in Huxley, two in Nevada, and six in Ames, and we'll do the same sites again this year. Registrations last summer at the Boys and Girls Club was outstanding, and so we continue to add more and more sessions until we had five sessions at that site alone. Advocacy. A team of Raising Readers staff and board members have been working to evaluate all of our programs using the Lexio process, and it's been facilitated by Malai Amfar from Story County Reads. We look very closely at all of the data and evaluation of our programs, and we have done an in-depth analysis of the programs by utilizing four literacy evaluation templates. For each of our programs, we looked at the following criteria. We looked at delivery mechanism, population profile, dosage, staff development, and evaluation. We then determined if any of the programs could be bolstered by providing additional training to our volunteers, our staff, or more in-depth evaluation, more parent engagement, etc. We also looked at how we could partner with other nonprofit agencies to provide literacy programs in programs that they already have in place. Again, we looked very closely at our programming data, and through the evaluation process, we are working on a partnership with YSS StorksNet to have a new location for our Storytime program. And we will also be going through all of the criteria to help that program be more robust in its new location. We anticipate that we will be doing story time for the older children while their parents are attending the bi-monthly meeting for StorksNet. This is just an example of how we can use the data to direct our implementation of our programming. Our program data specialist, Autumn Long, has more to tell you about data and evaluation.
So aside from the program evaluation,
I'm going to ask you to speak into that one.
Yeah.
Is, that okay? Is the other one working? Oh, sorry about that.
That's okay. No. So aside from the program evaluation that I do for Raising Readers, which has and is acting as a pilot of sorts for getting programmatic outcomes from school districts, I collaborate with community partners and schools countywide. The main part of what I work on is establishing countywide indicators and outcome measures to positively impact those leading indicators in the areas of education. Currently, I collect district data in relation to indicators such as third grade reading proficiency, as well as program-specific outcomes, such as with our Reading Buddies programs, where I get fast results from the school districts in relation to those students in our programs. I'm currently in conversations with school districts to make this a benefit for all community programs. One way that benefits Raising Readers is that we use the information from the school districts to know that what we're doing in our programs is translating to the school. Not only are they having growth in our program, but what they're doing in school is also being affected and making a positive outcome for those students. So we want to be able to provide that benefit to all community organizations and partners. Another countywide indicator I've been working on is a school readiness definition. So I've gotten data from representing kindergarten teachers from all seven of the Story County School Districts, and I'm using that to create a list of 10 school readiness skills or indicators that are specific to our county and what our kindergarten teachers think are important. Those skills then can be used by organizations to bolster programming, to help measure the outcomes and the effectiveness of our programs. Specifically for us, I know we'll be using it in our Super K and Story Pals programs to address, along with the literacy, some of the other additional skills that kindergarten teachers are saying are important in the county. All in all, the data is really helping us gain an understanding of our program effectiveness to make the biggest impact for our students and to provide that benefit to county organizations.
So that's just a snapshot of what we do at Raising Readers, and we wanted to thank you all for the support that you have given us in the past and in the future. Thank you.
Thank you. Four questions.
Just such an important program. Thank you guys so much. As you continue to transition year by year, thank you so much for the work you do.
Thank you.
Yeah, and I would also say that I am a former Raising Readers volunteer, and I realized from doing that volunteering is not easy. You know, sometimes keeping kids' attention and getting them focused on the right things. I feel miserably at that sometimes. So I just want you to tell your volunteers you do a hard job, and I realize it.
Thank you.
Thanks. Great seeing all of you this morning. I turn now with a smile to another group that I've had time to watch. and grow, maybe even work with a little bit. So welcome to the Central Iowa Tourism and the Ames Convention and Visitors Bureau. And if this gets any longer in your name, okay, I have to take a breath deeply. So welcome, Julie Weeks.
Thank you. It's great to be here. As you probably know, this will be my last report to the supervisors, so I wanted to make sure to introduce Crystal Davis to you today. Crystal represents us at CITR, our organization, and we have always had one of your two representatives. So I did want to talk about the benefits of Central Iowa Tourism Region to you just briefly today as well. So I did put together little packets for you. Sorry I did not get them mailed out ahead of time, but we're not asking for anything, so it's just pretty well informational. You do have two representatives, and the fee that you pay every year has been $700, and it will be $700 again. But for that, you do get the representation of two individuals, so I would recommend that since I will be going off, that you would appoint Crystal to be your one representative. But there's also some special projects that they're currently working on. The Iowa Tourism Institute, they have a leadership institute now, and we have sent three employees through that. Crystal will be finished, or has another year left in that, and Sean Damaris has finished that. They also participate in the Iowa State Career Fair, which is beneficial to a lot of the industry all of Central Iowa to reach out to students that could become involved in positions in the hospitality industry in all of Central Iowa. So we're glad that they do that. They also have an advocacy and legislative arm, and this year there's two initiatives that are really out there for the visitor industry. The first one is a change in the hotel motel tax law for statewide. And currently, if you stay in a hotel for more than 30 days, if you stay in one of the suite hotels for more than 30 days, you no longer pay the hotel motel tax. We're looking at extending that to the 90-day period of time. We don't want to get into true rental properties, but if you are a visitor staying in the area, we would like to see that hotel motel tax collected. The other thing we do is we continue to support the Economic Development Authority. They have a $500,000 grant system that is available to 10 convention and visitors bureaus for the specific person of bringing sporting events to the area. Sporting events have become a major economic driving force for us, but there are fees, usually bid fees and other fees associated with hosting those. So for the past 8 years, we have been able to get a $50,000 grant from the state of Iowa to help us bring things such as beat baseball, baseball for the blind, and some of those different sporting events. This year, we have a regional softball tournament will actually be held in Nevada that is supported by that grant. So that's very beneficial to us in Central Iowa as well. We also have grants and scholarships, and this year we were able to take advantage of two scholarships to send two of our new staff to the Iowa Tourism Conference. But they are all these benefits are available to employees and staff of the Story County as well because you are members of Central Iowa Tourism Region. One of the most things that we do are the educational monthly programs, and I'm going to have Crystal talk about those. She attends those, and she's been working on one with Story County Extension that we wanted to describe.
Good morning. Thanks for having me. We attend the Central Iowa Tourism Region about every other month. They have a meeting, and they rotate between locations in Central Iowa. And we're actually going to one tomorrow in Marshalltown to hear from the Travel Iowa staff on how to best use their resources and partnerships in promoting tourism here in Central Iowa. But we're pleased to announce that on April 11th, we are partnering with the Boone County Convention Visitors Bureau, the Boone and Story County Extension Outreach offices to host the first ever guide training. And this is a program that was written by our tourism arm in the Iowa State University Extension and Outreach office. And it hasn't been released yet. We're going to be the first site to do that. So we're really excited about that in the partnership with our county extension office as well. And this is for folks and organizations to learn more how to handle groups when they come on tours. You don't have to be a tour guide yourself to attend, but they're going to present some great information and tools to learn best practices as well as part two on how to be certified. And so we're really pleased that we'll be the first in the state to release that. And we've reached out to many of our members and other county entities and organizations to attend that as well. So looking forward to it.
Okay.
The last piece of information that I'd like to share is just a reminder of the value of the visitor industry in Story County. The state has an annual report done by the U.S. Travel Association, and we don't have 2018 numbers yet, but in 2017, visitors, according to their report, spent over $212 million in Story County. When we look at our tax collections in our annual report, which I also gave you a copy of, we can correlate that visitors, overnight visitors, I cannot begin to figure out how many visitors we have all together in Ames every year, but we can track overnight visitors, and they have spent over $120 million. That's on their hotel lodging, purchasing, retail, their food and beverage. There's an explanation of that in here. Also, our office does take 5% of our hotel motel tax, and we put it in a community grant fund. And I gave you a list of the 2019 in organizations and events that will be receive some funding from that community grant fund. It's over $88,000. And it does include things like Lincoln Highway Days, Senior Variety Show, Octagon Center for the Arts. So there's a huge variety of things that we do cover, and I'd just like to remind everyone of the value of those as well.
Okay. Any questions for us? Ward, any questions or comments? I know I've got a couple, but... Okay. So first is a process question. You said we have two reps. You recommend we appoint Crystal. All right. Happy to get that on next week's agenda. What would be your recommendation about the other representative?
It has normally been someone from Story City or Nevada.
Okay.
From the industry or associated with the chambers or in those areas. So, and I don't know if you have another one appointed at the moment. But
I don't know that we do. Maybe I'm looking out at staff. But so maybe it'll take us a couple of weeks if we can reach out and then go ahead and appoint both at the same time. The second thing I have to say is that we built additional money into our budget this year to handle some requests, additional requests. Right now, we pretty much have just built in year after year $4,000, I believe it was, for the summer games. Mm-hmm. And so this year we built in additional money. A few months ago, I'd asked a couple of our staff members to begin working on some kind of policy to bring before the board. Then the decision was that we put that off until we got through budget. We're now through budget. So I guess it's time I'll go hand that back to staff. And they'll be bringing forward, I hope, in the next couple weeks, then a recommended for us. I think where we kind of left the discussion was that I had looked at large events like National Mains and that drew a big number, but staff had a really good point that the board might want to look at others. Just to let you know that at some point we may be back to you to ask you to help publicize that if the board passes it, but it's about another $20,000.
That would be great.
Okay, so thanks. Great to see you guys again. Loved when I worked with you, and still just amazed at the groups you managed to bring in and the time you show them when they're here. So thank you.
It's been an honor. So thank you.
Thank you.
Right. Next, we go to consideration of minutes. I take a motion.
Move approval.
Second. Sander?
Aye.
Murphy?
Aye.
Olson? Aye. Consideration of personnel actions.
I would move approval of personnel actions as presented.
Second.
Okay. Merkin?
Aye.
Sanders?
Aye.
Olson? Aye. On the consent agenda, we are pulling item number five, the appointment to PMZ, and expect that maybe to come back on next week. So, I take motion for...
I move approval of consent agenda except for number five, which is in full.
Second.
Okay. Merkin?
Aye.
Sanders?
Aye.
Olson? Aye. All right. There are no public hearings today. So now we are on our little fuller agenda items, welcoming Leanne Harder up to the table. and we're going to have a discussion about the economic development process and our policies. And joining also is Lucy Martin, our auditor. Good morning, you two.
Good morning.
Leanne just asked me to make some general overview remarks about urban renewal and tax increment financing, just for the education of the audience or people that don't look at this stuff every day. So I would just ask you take away just a few items about TIF, is that any levying authority that uses tax increment financing, we don't collect money and then look for projects. We actually have projects and collect only the money that we certify to the auditor. And all entities that use tax increment financing certify their debt to the auditor by December 1st of every year. And then we do an estimation based on that in the valuation, part of the valuation report process, and then they certify their levy based on the valuation report. So we're always estimating what we're using, and we're always using the previous year's levy to estimate how much TIF revenue we're going to get, which is, this is a really basic presentation of that. So you take the consolidated levy, or whatever authority you're in, and then you take away all debt service is held harmless from TIF. It's the school district, their PEPL, both regular and voted, is held harmless. And then since 2014, also their instruction support levy. And that gives you a TIF levy. So for FY20, for the county, we used the 19 levy to estimate what we were going to get for FY20 in terms of our TIF levy.
And I have a question about the majority of what is TIFed is in the Colonesco School District, but do we have other school districts?
We have 12. So we have an urban renewal area, which is everything, and then within that we have 12 TIF districts, and those are in 7 different taxing districts.
Okay, thank you.
So I know people would really like to ask, like, what does one wind turbine get me in TIF?
Mm-hmm.
Which I would love to answer that question, but I would say, well, what taxing district is it in and what year are we talking about? Because everything, there's a lot of stuff that's out of our hands. So, am I not getting recorded? Sorry.
It's recording, but it's not very much. I just don't want to look at it.
So,
okay. So, like I said, we have TIF money tied up in coming out of 12 TIF, 7 different taxing districts. But the majority of that is in Lincoln Township, so I'm just showing you over time what has happened to the TIF levy rate there. So FY13, which we used for FY14 projections, we had basically $24 per $1,000 of increment value. Now, for the upcoming FY20 year, we're down to 20. So that's why when you talk to Lisa and say, what kind of money are we going to get in the future, we're really hesitant to give you anything that's we can give you an estimate, but it can change pretty quickly, as you can see over time what happened here just in that one, which is where we have the wind farm. Well, part of the wind farm. So that's another thing. When Leanne is going to show her report, and I don't want to get into this too much. I have a whole TIF presentation, but it's 45 minutes, and I'm not going to belabor that today. I forgot what I was going to say. When she's looking at things, she's looking at it by project, and it's a lot like our budget. So we levy by service area, but then we spend by department or office, and we have to do that crosswalk. So when we talk about the wind farm, you're actually talking about 3 different TIF districts from that one project in the initial year. So
that's it in a nutshell. That's what I came here today to say. I hope that helps clarify some remarks.
Yeah, I would just underscore, it's all gray area. There's not black and white here. It's hard when you see a presentation that tries to assume that there's black and white here, and I appreciate you putting it together for us, Lucy.
Yeah, there might have been or the arrow, or this. I think the keyboard's not responding very well. So what I'm going to do is try and break it down then a little bit further for the benefit of those in the audience, but then also just for re-education myself, because this is not necessarily something, it's something almost every year I have to review and reevaluate. So I'm going to talk about the economic development process and policies, but a little bit, I'm going to go to the next one. I want to step back and review the elements of our urban renewal program based on tax increment financing. They're kind of interchangeable how we talk about. We talk about the TIF program. Technically, it's the urban renewal program for Story County using the tool of tax increment financing. It has three main elements, but as Lucy mentioned, one of the other elements that's kind of the silent but most difficult one is the administration component. The 12 TIF districts, reporting mechanisms. I'm not going to touch on that at all. But three elements of the urban renewal program, the urban renewal plan, and that is all of Story County, unincorporated areas, and within city limits for projects. The Chapter 8 of the Code of Ordinances, which is entitled Urban Renewal, and then the economic development process and policies. Specifically today, we're going to talk about some changes to that last component, but I do want to review the other two elements. The Urban Renewal Plan kind of came hand in hand at the same time with Chapter 8, Urban Renewal, in the Code of Ordinances. This was adopted initially in November 2011. This does set the stage so the county can TIF different properties. It's set out following the guidance of Chapter 403 of the Code of Iowa. And again, all the requirements set forth in the code are satisfied by adopting this plan. This is what we use to certify that debt annually then by December. Chapter 8 is then in the Code of Ordinances. This is the element of our urban renewal practices, TIF practices program, that we identify the properties from which the tax increment financing is based. That is Chapter 8. It was added to the Code of Ordinances in 2011, so hand-in-hand with the Urban Renewal Plan adoption. Every time a project is added to the Urban Renewal Plan, every time a property is added from which to assume, from which taxes may be assessed or gathered, that's added to Chapter 8. Excellent. And then the economic development process and policies, these came about a year later, adopted by the Board of Supervisors in October 2012 originally. And as it says, it's developed to establish structure and objectivities and standard operating procedures for evaluating economic development projects. And that's where we are today.
Leanne, I have a question about project versus the plan itself. Okay, so can you explain for the audience the difference about our plan, which is all of Story County, versus projects?
Projects are identified in the plan. The plan is very simple in its approach. It just sets forth the purpose of having an urban renewal area plan for Story County. And then it goes and it lists the properties from which taxes are set up for the TIF projects, and then it lists the projects. And so every time the board decides to add a project, and that could be everything from like Dakin's Lake to the community projects such as in Colonesco or in Zierin for Colonesco School District, that plan gets amended to incorporate them, and then that is then what is used to certify the debt.
So what about areas then? Do some counties set up separate areas?
Yes.
And
for us, countywide.
Right, and we do countywide.
With 12 right. different TIF districts within there.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay, now I'm going to go to the review of the economic development process and policies. The next few slides, definitely for the board, should look very familiar. I may have Lucy breeze through them. These are the, this is the language that is an economic development process and policies. The additions or deletions are noted with underline or strikeouts. And these are all based on Supervisor Olson's recommendations from a meeting earlier, I think in January, or sometime maybe a few weeks ago, actually. The eligibility section, the suggestion is to add an eligibility criteria E, housing development, rehabilitation, and or conversion. I'm going to go through all the changes first.
Sure.
And then I have some slides on amounts. Next one. In this case, the next is to amend the language regarding the limitation for private businesses. Everyone can read that, but it is some changing the dynamics of the language, and that, again, adding the housing component here. No changes to this section other than I do want to share that there is a, when we're talking about projects from communities and other entities, the expectation is there's a 25% match to the total project cost. This is a suggestion I am putting forth. If we were to do projects, that we push it back to the third Tuesday of April. This is the pre-application conference required for entities to come meet with me. I just, or whomever is responsible for the program, I'm cognizant of the limitations and how busy people are in March and the first part of April with budgets. School districts by the 15th, counties and cities, in March, I'd like to recognize their time. Okay. Any questions on changes before I talk about what we've awarded thus far? This is very familiar, but I just recap some numbers for the board and the audience. For projects through the economic development process and policy since 2012 when it was adopted, the board has awarded almost $1.3 million in funded projects. And then if you look at county projects, so these are specifically under the guidance of Story County, Dakins Lake, the bike improvements along Country Club Road, south of Nevada, paving of 590th Prairie Trail, planning, and then the Tedesco Environmental Learning Corridor project, that's a little under $7.5 million, $7,474,000. So all of those on the two previous slides are actually projects that are identified in the urban renewal plan. The TIF revenues are set out, as I said earlier, in Chapter 8, Urban Renewal, the Code of Ordinances. In total, there are 138 turbines and then better equipment along 590th and Highway 30, from which revenues are gathered, collected. And then I just thought it'd be interesting to look at turbines by owner, since the majority of our revenues are from wind turbines. There are several different owners, LLCs, whatever it may be, mechanism may be, of the 138 wind turbines in Story County. I want to thank Wayne Shukaroff for giving me this information to populate the table, too. But definitely the wind, Story Wind and the Garden Wind are the next era energy projects. Those are the largest, and those are in majority in the Colonesco School District. The others are associated with other school districts throughout Story County. And the base assessment year is the third column in there, and it does show how we've ramped up over the years as like Michelangelo Wind and Optimum Wind came on in 2018. We knew their permits were granted in 2016. And then they hit the year 7, which is the 30% of the valuation, according to the schedule that the board has adopted in the last column.
And yeah, that's assessment year, so
yeah.
Anytime you see assessment year, add 2, and that gets you the fiscal year. Mm-hmm. So assessment year 18 is used for FY20.
So then taxes will first be paid by Michelangelo and Optimum then in 2014 or 2024 or 2026? When will that 30% first be coming into our coffers?
Well, Well, it comes in at 5%
right.
in 7 years, but it maxes in FY26.
Okay, thank you.
Next steps, or any additional questions on those few number slides?
No, thank you.
Identify any additional modifications that are necessary. I would like some direction from the board today so that I can bring back those modifications for official action on next Tuesday, April 2nd. That will then set the stage for the next steps if we do open up programs, whatever it may be, and how I go forward and amend the urban renewal plan. If we do go as in the past, I did say that Monday, April 8th would be the meeting. It would probably be Monday, April 22nd.
Okay. Okay.
Leanne, can you go back to the page that shows the city-specific projects?
Sure, right there.
Any cities that aren't listed up there?
I'm sorry, what?
Do we have any Story County cities that have not participated yet that we haven't done anything in?
Ames.
Okay. So the question is, do you consider TELC being an Ames project, even though it's not Ames combined with money, but do you consider it of mostly benefit to?
Who owns the ground?
We own the ground.
Okay.
And then Colo is the other community. Even though it's listed on the table, they've not received any.
Okay.
So, I'm going to ask, first of all, Leanne, okay, can you come back to your slide for next steps, please?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, first on her list, identify additional modifications. Are there any modifications that anybody wants to make to this particular proposed policy as presented here? So what we've got now is, do we want to change anything?
Yeah, I don't want to. So if you're saying, do I want to change anything over what it is as it exists, I don't want to change anything as it exists. If you're saying, do you want to change anything from the presentation, yes, I don't like the idea of going to limited rebates to private businesses.
Mm-hmm.
And if you don't like the idea of government picking winners and losers of who's going to get it in private business, then I don't see a way that you can utilize TIF for housing development, because you're talking about using private developers and private ownership to get that done. And so those two go hand in hand. And you and I have talked about this before, Loris. I fundamentally disagree with using TIF in this way. I don't disagree with the idea of housing. I just disagree with TIF being used for housing.
And I'm a proponent
Sure.
of it being used for housing. And as I spent the last year talking to individuals, talking to city councils, hearing updates one by one, it became very clear to me that my original concept in most instances, which was just to take a cash pot of money and then to have an application process separate from that, was not going to be feasible given all of the different needs in the different communities. I mean, that became clear, and sometimes you have to abandon a project or a thought. So, but what did come through very clearly that was consistent is that the communities needed help sometimes in putting together development deals, and I was interested in focusing on the low income or the conversion projects, the affordable housing as we define anymore as low to moderate, as fifth of the 60% of the median, and also looking at starter projects. And that is where it started to come together, that sometimes when you're talking about a very small developer, for example, the gentleman in Cambridge who has redone the elementary school there, he's done four or five of the units, he has four or five left to go, and some type of assistance to him would be a benefit, and he could finish off those other five units. And so you talk about Maxwell, the Maxwell deal that fell apart, and they couldn't come together with the developer. You get in the smaller communities, and they often, they don't have that resource, but they, in some way, if sometimes it could be done through chipping the homes themselves and returning that back. And I'm not real fond of the rebate concept also. I'm more liking that it may go through a city using a grant. Okay, so I'm willing to negotiate on the language here, but I'd like to leave the housing development, rehab, and conversion in.
Yeah, so here's the problem with that. We don't have the authority to TIF a property that is within a city limit. So if you're talking about using the Cambridge example, we don't, as a county, unless City of Cambridge agrees, we can't go in and TIF that. They do have the authority to TIF that. Exactly.
I'm sorry. I didn't hear what Lucy said.
If the county wants to TIF within municipal corporate boundaries, they need a permission of
right.
The city.
Correct.
The
correct.
City controls everything within
correct.
The city
but
boundaries.
That is that. So that is still we're able to do it via the permission of the city.
Well, but the city could go ahead and do it on their own. If they wanted to do it, they could go ahead and do it on their own. Second thing is this, by replacing the word no with limited, you fundamentally change what the intent of this original document was. And this original document was intended to say, we are going to utilize these dollars for public good. We aren't utilizing these dollars for things like housing development. That is Cambridge's responsibility, or Ames' responsibility, or Nevada's responsibility, and we're going to use it for things like Tedesco, things like Dakin's Lake, other potential projects that seem to benefit the public without picking private winners and losers.
So,
and so it's just a fundamental change.
Okay. So, like I said, I'm willing to negotiate, by negotiator, whatever, accept the premise about that you don't like the money flowing directly to the developer. So that would be to go back to the no. Okay. But the communities can still work with us so that we can provide some of the chipping ability here through us, to put together packages with the developers themselves, or in the case of people who are doing infill lots, there's a lot of possibilities out there, and I want to be able to take a look at them, realizing there might be viability behind what we do. So if you really feel strongly that it doesn't go toward any private entity, that still doesn't mean that we can't start looking at projects that actually down the road will yield some taxes back. I mean, I look at our current policy here, and all we're doing is funding public projects that never return a yield to the tax base. And that is fundamentally uncomfortable for
yeah,
me.
Yeah, but it's not accurate. It might be fundamentally uncomfortable for you. So the reality is the big projects we've done, right? We're not going to collect taxes on Dakin's Lake. We're not going to collect taxes until 100%. 100% right there. But you go back to those city projects that we did, the reality is we may in fact end up collecting taxes on some of those. Just the way we did it, they were city acquired properties when we funded it.
Some of them.
And I don't know if any of them now have moved back into public hands or not, but we ran it all through the city. The county did not run that. We were a funder. I'm comfortable being a funder. I'm just not comfortable with us directly getting in the middle of it. If it's going through the city, I feel a lot better about it, but that's not what you're suggesting here. You're suggesting that we become a direct player to private people and industry.
And I'm going to go back to through the city. I mean, and then the
we already have that, though.
But the cities, though, can only apply for the items that are on the list. So I want to add housing development and rehab and conversion to the list. So if you want to go back to the requirements here, I still think a program could be put together in the city that would keep us from having to go directly to the developer. So I'm very, very amenable to saying, all right, we're not going to look at that project,
where we go in and TIF cooperatively, or allow the city would allow us to TIF to give the funds to the developer. I hear that's where the difference is here. But we still, going back here to eligibility, if we add housing development, rehab, and or conversion, then it would come through an application through the city again, and the city would administer it. And that model you're talking about is very similar to what the Story County Housing Trust Fund is doing right now. So I'm open to following that route and taking out the change in the language there.
Yeah, so I don't view that, and Leanne helped me with this, I don't view that as a whole lot different than the Main Street and Town Center revitalization. If a project had come forward of these last few that had included residential, so had included some kind of residential component on the second floor, I don't know if it would have been disqualified in our current process or not. So I'm not seeing the addition of that, as long as we maintain the no rebates back to private industry, I'm not seeing that this fundamentally changes the policies we have. I think the limited to no to limited would change.
I think I would agree with that. I think the limited to no does, removing that suggests changes alleviate some of my concerns with program administration. If the board were to decide to add the fee and directions given to run it in the same manner or the program as I have in the past, or whomever's doing it in the past, with accepting deadlines, applications due at this time, amending the plan, that does, again, alleviate some of my concerns, because there is the process involved in that.
And now we are back to what the original working discussion. What did we end up with that? Calling it a working group of you, Brenda Dreyer, and me, and who was the fourth person in that?
Deb.
Deb, thank you, Deb Shildroth. Remember the original plan we kind of worked on as a draft? That then would go back to very similar to what we ended up producing back in December of 2017 that the board wasn't willing to do. So have we reached a consensus here that housing development, rehab, and or stays on? And I feel comfortable about that, because I do believe that communities have thought they couldn't do it before, that they couldn't rehab for housing, or do housing development in their own community and use the money to run utilities up to lots, and et cetera. But if we leave that and we go back to the original wording about no money to private, I see none.
Are you asking if I have something to say on that?
I am. Yes.
Thank you.
Yes, you're right. We kind of got in a two-way conversation.
I think that what we're talking about here does contribute to public good. Housing is a major issue throughout our county. If this adds some clarity and helps people understand that we would take an application that was dealing with housing development, I think that's a good thing. I personally, this doesn't say we're going to grant any money for housing. It says we will consider it. And I think that's important. And I will say, for me in particular, I want to see some data. I want to see what a need is in any particular community. And I want to see a specific plan as to how this project would address that need. I don't believe in pilot projects unless they still have some data behind them, and unless they are addressing a problem that has been factually proven. So I would just add that to it. It does not mean that we're automatically going to say, oh, Town X wants money for housing, therefore.
When I originally started this back in the...
Could I ask another thing?
Yeah.
I'm not sure what you're saying that you would change in that language right there.
I don't want limited instead of no.
Why asking Morris?
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Okay. I would go back, I would strike the limited and go back to no, and then we'd take out the except. We'd take out everything in red here, because that's the exception that defines the limited. So I would strike all of the red and go and just leave what's up there. No would return,
and give.
You're talking about leaving it as it is. You would put back in recognition of governments limited, blah, blah.
No.
You were, okay.
So just be no, and then strike all the red that I'd added, but I would not put back in recognition. I think that it's just, period, we won't use TIF funds.
I don't think it's necessary.
Yeah.
Have that introductory clause, so I could agree with that.
Okay. In response to your question about the data, that as originally to the previous board, starting in, I believe, the summer of 2017, it might have been earlier, I'd have to go back and look, the actual proposal that some of us also discussed and worked on is trying to get the update to the Story County housing needs assessment, thank you, that had last been done in 1997. And the previous board declined to fund it. So then the shift went over to the Story County Economic Development Group. Who would it be assigned to? The previous board wasn't interested in it being assigned to us, to Leanne, to kind of spearhead a committee. So then it went to the Story County Economic Development Group. If they would spearhead it, and they decided not to spearhead it because we were so close to the 2020 census. So certainly I bet that we could work with the communities to put together some data based from the communities, but I don't think you're going to get a needs assessment, so that's all been pushed down, pushed back, finally, the release. Plus the fact that happened is the Iowa Finance Authority said they were issuing a big project with all kinds of this data updated, but when the project came out, it had Story County some data, but it was focused on it. So just to let you know that as far as the requirement for data, certainly I think that it's fair that we pull together what we can, but a lot of the formal and us providing funding for what would have been a very comprehensive plan has been pushed off. We still have to decide on that. Is that a good, accurate description? You think?
Yeah.
Okay. So coming back here, all right. So the proposal, Leanne, would be to add housing development rehab and or conversion, and then the language here would end up reading no increment rebate, grants, loans, or assistance to private business. Story County will not use TIF funds to participate in any direct disbursement or rebate to a private entity, period. Okay. Thank you on that. All right.
Does this change? So the
pre-application
conference
attorney. That makes sense.
Yeah, but there's no problem there. So then we have consensus on the instructions here that you bring this forward for official action, a vote by the board on Tuesday, April 2nd. You're welcome. And now we're going to identify the types of programs and opportunities for 2019. We had a discussion in January, I believe it was, about what types of programs we were still interested in supporting. And Leanne, can you recap for that quickly for us about that?
Whether or not it goes down, it gets to the basic question whether or not the board wants to open up the program as in years past to the communities and school districts or non-private entities. As just previously discussed, that limitation discussion for the program as we've done.
And this program that we're discussing has been those small, grants, community type grants that would go to help within one of those areas. The communities apply themselves individually. There's a process involved. There's a deadline, and then they're brought before the board to fund. And I saw Lisa Markway walk, and she might have had to go down the hall or something, but I believe she's told us in previous sessions there's about $160,000 to $190,000 she thought was built into the fiscal year 20 budget.
It says 110 here on what they gave.
And that's one of my questions for, so that's why I kind of wanted to ask it. Lucy, possibly you can explain to us that, oh, there she is. Hi. We're discussing that as we were going through the budget workshop. You had told us that you thought that it was about $160,000 to $190,000 maximum that we could use for the TIF grant program.
Right.
All right. On our actual physical sheets that we've been given, it shows $110,000. And so can you explain to us where the difference is?
I think we've covered this numerous times. Every time I do this, of what we
sure.
Assumed.
Okay.
So at this point in time, this number shows actually 144.
Right.
33 and 110. And that's an estimated 19
right.
revenue and an estimated 20.
So at the estimated 144, mm-hmm. All right, some of those funds are from 19. Do they or do they not roll over to be combined with the...
So we haven't certified debt on that yet.
All right.
The option will be when you certify debt this year, you can certify that debt.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. And we're certifying it at the 33 or the 144?
144.
Thank you. All right.
And let's just be really clear here. Every year we've done better. I mean, you guys do such a great job being very conservative in your estimates. And so if you look, Loris, our last actual was 952. Our actual in 17 was over a million. The reality is what we're seeing is Colonesco School District's levy has dropped by almost $5 per thousand over the last few years, and that's why you saw the drop there. But it did not drop year over year the last 2 years. And so what I'm suggesting to you is I love that we estimate conservatively in terms of revenue, but the 888 that you see there as far as an estimate in revenues, we're going to do better than that, which is why we end up with a leftover every year because we do budget so conservatively.
And to address that new numbers have been run, the auditor's department, the last few days, along with working with Leanne, working with the assessor, working with supervisors, working with staff. I mean, I can't think of anybody who didn't have a question or a hand in it to try and really get the projections as close they could based upon what they knew and didn't know. And I would like to point out that from my presentation 2 weeks ago, using those first projections to what was provided here as our update, picked up $350,000 over 6 years. So, you know, that's a good example exactly about where near, as long as all of the assumptions are correct in the projections. So, yeah.
But it's the assumptions and the projections that create these issues. So talk about the raw data, right? So the reality is that as we sit here today, for FY17 tax valuation, which is what we're collecting this year, we've got almost $103 million in available TIF properties. Now, we said we're only going to take 50% of that, right? So 102, and if you use the thumbnail of $20, I think Lucy and Lisa are using more like $19, but if you use kind of the rough $20, it's about just over $2 million that you got available.
$2.3 million.
Exactly. We said 50%. Of that is where we're going to be. But what's important is, Loris, you look at it in 17, it's almost $103 million, just under $103 million. If we don't do anything, just based on the valuations of the wind towers, by 2024, it's up over $115 million. Of total valuation.
Right.
And so while our policies are 50%, the policies are controlled by whoever sits at this table right here. And so instead of getting bogged down in this assumption or that projection, just use the raw data. And the raw data tells us very clearly it's between 102 and 103 million today, going to over 115 million over the next 6 years.
Okay. And so as I said, you know, I mean, I added up when I compared what had been used on the 12th as compared to what is now we were provided with yesterday. It's a $350,000 increase in projection
above what I had on the 12th. It's over 6 years, so that's, you know, roughly we're looking at, what, about 6 to 7, but 52, 55, you know, I'm a journalist, my math isn't that tight. So there is more coming in as far as after the 50%. And so then the next thing that you brought up is a change in the policy about how much to take. And that's,
I brought it up simply that we could do it.
Right.
And I brought it up in whatever this body deems as a priority. So when we talked about this last, I felt like you were making the case that we did not have the capacity to do it. We absolutely have the capacity to do it. There's no question we have the capacity to do it, which is the point I made. Now, whether we choose to do it, that's a different conversation. But I was uncomfortable that you tried to make the case that your decision was based on that we didn't have the capacity. Your decision could be based on whatever you want, but we absolutely have the capacity.
We don't have the capacity. I still believe that we don't have the capacity to do that and still carry forward on the priorities that we had already discussed in January. So it really does come down to, I think you and I are in agreement about, is what our priorities and who might get left out. And I'm very supportive of, we keep our existing programs going, and given our debt levy, given the amount of debt that we already are paying out of that revenue every year, that's what I look at. I look at what's available for us to spend based on the projections. I pick up $350,000 over 6 years that's available to spend. But we still have a lot of debt on it. Some of that debt doesn't go away until fiscal year 22. So yes, I still don't think that we have the capacity $2 million, okay, but I still don't believe that, and keeping our other priorities and our commitments that other communities.
Sure, but the last caveat, Loris, that you're adding changes everything, because I would say most people that listened to our conversation last time, I know I got several contacts from several people that are in the audience right now with, there's not clarity on whether the county could do this if the county chose to. And let's just be completely clear. If you're saying this doesn't rise to the level of meeting what you want to do in comparison to other things, that's fine. That's a choice. But that's not the impression that people got a couple weeks ago when we talked about this. They got the impression that the county did not have the capacity to do it. And all I said all the way through is, we absolutely have the capacity. Now, if you want to pick and choose, that's fine. Prioritize whatever you want, and if this doesn't rise to the level to do, if any project doesn't rise to the level that you feel like it's a priority, I'm all in. That's what each of us get to do, but we shouldn't couch it in that the county just fundamentally doesn't have the capacity when we do.
I take a look at what, and I believe that in the next part of the discussion, we're kind of rolling these two together, is that there is a payment amortization schedule up, and that we would have to, that it shows that we would not have enough money for the next 3 years, cash inflow, to make the first 3 year payments.
That's not right, because again, you're not looking at the calendar as it flows. The reality is the first payment, and so you're right, we are convoluting two different conversations. But if the first payment is not until 21 and 22, the reality is there's plenty of dollars there to do that. You're trying to look at today's dollars and say there's not enough, and this is 3 years down the road.
We're getting at 20, though. If I understood the presentation, is that I believe we're starting in 20. So now we are here back to next steps, okay, because we are going to try and keep these separated as much as possible, because the discussion is identify the types of programs and opportunities for 2019. So if I'm summarizing our discussion minus the dollars correctly, what we're talking about now is do we want to be supportive of the programs that we've already done to the extent that we can do them.
given the schedule of coming in. Starting year in fiscal year 20, which shows we have revenue of $77,000. Now Lisa said it's 144 we could do. All right, so we have $144,000 for 20, and then that's what we have. What would be the payment, et cetera, on that, or what do you want to use that $144,000 for? That's really the core question. What are your priorities for the 144? We just talked in January about supporting our current priorities, which would mean some money would go to the 144 might or go out there.
So if we're talking about this year, which is the 2020 conversation, then I believe that this is a year that we should ask for applications from our smaller communities for projects they might have. And I'll go back to what Linda said because I couldn't agree with her more. Just because we get an application doesn't mean we're going to fund it.
Correct.
But where I'm afraid this is convoluted in that you think this conversation about this 144 has anything to do with the next topic we're going to talk about. The two are not related at all. If we're talking about whether we're going to accept applications for this year, so we took 1 year off. We had received applications for
Correct.
How many years? 4 or 5. And then we took 1 year off from receiving applications. I believe this is another year where we should take applications and see what kind of projects
are
out there.
I have a question for Leanne, please.
Go for it.
So we'd be moving our schedule back to the third week of April. What would you see in terms of when we would be awarding the grants under the Small Communities Program?
I would be bringing it forward to the board to start amending the urban renewal plan in August and September. Mm-hmm. So that we can make sure we meet all the legal requirements.
December 1st is the magic number.
Right. And we have to really back up a couple months.
What I was concerned about was Housestead Bill 165 and what's going to happen there, and where you might say that doesn't really affect TIF. Everything affects everything. So that makes me have comfort with that we would have a better idea of what our revenues were like overall. I would agree that we should put in the Small Communities Grant.
That's okay.
Yeah, is 150, just because it's a...
So that's not, as I see it, that's not necessary at this point. We receive applications. We know in our mind that we've got 144 plus, but you know, and I can't recall a time that we've used every dollar. Maybe there was 1 year that we went all the way up to what we really thought we had available, but generally we've looked at projects based on the project specific. And have not put an artificial cap up front, but it's something we consider when we review the applications.
It's good to have a number in mind, though, so that's why it's good to know what could be available. And thank you for running all these numbers for us.
And to clarify also that what it says here, 2019, is actually the first part of our fiscal year, 20, but for the TIF collections, it's 2019, correct? Because we're certified by December 1st, 2019.
No, well, that's for my benefit. That's the calendar year 2019.
Calendar year 2019, correct. Yeah, so I know, yes, Rick, I know we're not in a fiscal year.
Well,
we're on this
right
calendar year.
No, I got that. But again, you got to look two different directions depending on what we're talking about. So if we're talking about using dollars that are already in the TIP program, you look backwards. Right, so it's from December 1st backwards.
So we're collecting right now for fiscal year 2017 or 2018 we're going to start collecting.
So we're collecting dollars for FY 19 right now based on the 17 valuations.
Right.
That's what throws it all off. But when you're talking about these project-specific one-time off, you look backwards. Right, how much money we have in the program. When you look at things like TILC, Dakin's Lake or any other projects that we might consider bonding for, you look forwards, not backwards, because you don't, so you would certify in December of any given year, but you wouldn't start collecting those taxes all the way till September of the next year, which is why I think there's confusion of what year this stuff kicks in.
And so you're feeling that they've asked for money in 20, correct, or 2021. When do you want your first check, Nancy?
For the capital 2021.
2021. Okay. All right. Okay. You're right. I'm off by 1 year.
So it doesn't kick till FY22 is when the first taxes kick in.
All right. Okay. Supervisor Sanders is correct. I'm 1 year off on my schedule. All right. So this still comes back to then, well, let's finish out this discussion and we'll move to the next one then, part of that financial discussion. So are we all in agreement here that we've reached the agreement that we can ask Leanne to come back next week with to ask for official action on this? And the dollar amount we're looking at, you just put in 150?
No,
you don't use the
dollar amount. No dollar amount.
All right.
Just we're going to accept application.
Okay.
As a pre-application conference, I do generally get asked the question, how much money are we looking at from the community?
Uh-huh.
And I just use the latest amount that Lisa gives me and qualify it. This is an estimate.
Okay, that's good.
The other qualifier, the board may not fund every year any application.
Okay.
We always have the right to say no.
All right.
I'm comfortable that we give Leanne that direction.
Right. You have your directions. Thank you very much. All right, let's move on to the next one then, which has been closely related and overlapping here, is discussion and consideration of a revised financial support request for $2 million toward the construction of a $48 million Healthy Life Center proposed for the City of Ames and a commitment to provide an ongoing operating subsidy of $100,000 per year. Everyone's seen the request. I'll give 2 minutes if somebody wants to come up and make a presentation. Otherwise, I think we know what it's for, what it's about, and no? All right. At this point, we open it to the board because, as you've heard from the previous discussions and discussions on March 12th, that at least for me, it is a great come down to whether the county can afford this, and afford for me means also keeping the commitments and keeping within the 50% of going forward. So I open it up to whichever supervisor would like to talk a little bit about there.
First, just a point of clarification that I'd request.
Mm-hmm.
Because I've heard from some people that they think the county has enough money in reserves to simply pay cash. I don't think that's the case. Somebody told me they thought there was something between $17 and $22 million in reserves. That is not the case. And I might ask Lisa to comment on that if she could. So we have our fiscal staff.
I did send you fund balance information so that you had in front of you what the actual ending fund balance for FY20 was projected to be. And the only dollars that are not restricted use dollars would be the $6 million worth of general fund unassigned, which 25% of that. We like to budget 25% of our expenses, so we have some dollars to get through the first quarter, which is like $4.8 million. And then everything else of the $22 million that you mm-hmm. are referring to are restricted use funds. We have numerous funds that personally violate can only be used for certain purposes and not general and assigned.
But we do have $22 million in reserve.
We have $22 million sitting in our funds that is not, but not all of it is
sure.
Absolutely. Available.
Is all of it general? Because I
no.
came up with, yeah,
no.
It's about 17 to 18 is general, just right? And then
no.
No?
No, the general fund ending fund balance for the budget for FY20 is $9.9 million. Of that $9 million, we have assigned and or committed all but $6
million. Correct. Right.
The $6 million, again, is like 30% of the expenses for the general fund. It's about $18.5 million of general fund expenditures next year budgeted.
And of that $6 million, $4.8 for cash flow purposes, correct?
Correct. And side note, which I had this conversation with you briefly this morning, was I'll be coming back to you next week. A couple weeks for a budget amendment to use $500,000 of those general fund dollars for a budget amendment for the end of FY19.
Which would then take the reserve, so to speak, to under $1 million. The unassigned funds to under $1 million. Thank you very much.
I received, I think, that same communication, and I was up at 10 o'clock replying to the person last night, and I gave her the permission to share if he wanted. I laid it out a little bit more like a household budget, but after I worked out with what we knew, we were already going to have to dip into the fund after the six, you know, starting with the $6 million. I ended up that we could be, as far as true free cash, if you want to call it, at between $300,000 and $350,000. But I think the key point I'd like to also emphasize, and I emphasized to this person last night, is that the steering committee has asked that we not have a bond issue, and that's related to the general fund. And so I checked with our attorney, a civil attorney who was in the back again this morning. He had to leave, but I said, if I understand your interpretation of the law, that if we use any of our general funds money for brick and mortar, is what I call it, okay, that we're going to reach the cap, the legal cap, before we have to have an election. So I guess it, from the purpose of the Healthy Life Center, it doesn't matter how much is in that reserve account. I can spend it down, and my expectations down to $350,000. But if you want us to use one dime of that money for anything other than the payments, and that's a whole other set of legal requirements with it for the subsidy, we've got to have that bond issue. So that really knocks whatever the balance of the general fund is, it knocks it out. It's not really there.
So can and should are two different things. The realities are this. We've got $22 million in reserves. The other reality is this. 25% is what we are comfortable having in access to general fund, but there's been many times in Story County's past that it's been below the 25%. Another reality is this, assigned funds are different than committed funds. And if something terrible happened in Story County, we had a roof collapse or a whatever, something terrible, the reality is Story County could write a $3 million check tomorrow if it had to. Now, I have never felt like that we ought to use general fund dollars for the Healthy Life Center. So that's an entirely different conversation. But again, the conversation starts to get convoluted because the case was just made that we didn't have $22 million in reserves. We do. The case was also made that we couldn't write a $3 million check if we had to. We can. Can and should are entirely different. But I don't like that we're given false impressions of what is reality.
I think using the term reserves there is a little misleading. A reserve to me is some money that you have that you don't have any particular need for. We're talking on hand.
Yeah, you need to talk to the state then, because I'm just using the state definition of what we put in, and it's $22 million in reserves.
Nevertheless, my only really... all I wanted to do was clarify that we didn't have $17 to $22 million just sitting around, of which $2 million would not be a big deal. That's all I wanted to clarify, so maybe we can head past that.
Sure. I'm sitting here listening to the argument here about writing out a check. Yeah, we can write a check out. We get a roof flap. We had one. Yeah, we were lucky we're covered by insurance. But let's talk about a major disaster. We've got money in the bank to cover a major disaster, and we can free up some of those assigned funds. But what's the purpose and the point of doing a budget and keeping a close watch on your funds if you're going to just move them around when an ask for a non-essential, and that's my definition of this, comes to us. And I think that's a difference in philosophy. I know when I sat here during these budget workshops, I was trying to be very conscious of taxpayer dollars and knowing where we needed to put everything. And if you sit through these, you listen to some discussions where you start having exchanges with employees or other elected officials over as little as $100 or $150. And so that your statement doesn't agree with how I view the budget. I'm not saying it's right or wrong.
Have you heard me suggest that we ought to move money around? I started the whole conversation with I don't believe we should. And the other point I've got to make when you start throwing out that you're the champion of tax dollars, when I sat in this chair for the first time in 2010, total, we had just over $7 million in reserves, and we got $22 million in reserves today. Compare apples to apples.
And
let's talk about the issue in front of us today, please.
Okay. So thank you for redirecting us. So the issue today is a request for $2 million, as I said, and an ongoing operating subsidy of $100,000. Leaving the dollar amount aside for a minute. Are there other questions or concerns that the board would like to discuss about this particular ask? Philosophical concerns that haven't been brought up or that you'd like to re-bring up?
I just want to make one comment because it relates to something Rick said. Looking at the list of Story County projects that were funded, and you mentioned that Ames was not on the list in small communities grants. Well, it's small communities grants, so it's not. But I think that when we're looking at the county projects, I think folks in Zeering feel like Bacon's Lake has been of big benefit to them, despite the fact that Zeering doesn't own that. I think that the folks in McCallsburg, should we get the Prairie Rail Trail put together? I know that's a huge issue for them. If we can, once we're moving on that, I think they will feel, like they told me, that's a great economic benefit. That's great benefit to McCallsburg. I think also that the TELF is of great benefit to Ames, in particular to Iowa State and research work. So I would just look at it that way.
Okay. Thank you.
That's the only thing I wanted to say.
Okay. I think I've made myself clear. Is there going to be a motion?
Yeah, I mean, it was a great project. March 12th that we could have afforded it $3,200,000 a year. I still am not a fan of the straight $100,000 with a 3% inflator, regardless of what the deficit looks like. I still believe that it ought to be tied to whether there is a deficit or not. But I believe strongly this is something that the county ought to participate in. It's you mentioned that Dakin's Lake is good for Zeering, and it absolutely is good for Zeering, but it's good for a lot more than Zeering. And you mentioned that TILT is good for Ames, and it is good for Ames, but it's good for a lot more than just Ames. And I feel exactly the same way about the Healthy Life Center and the partnerships that have been worked so hard to form in this. And us losing sight of the benefit to Story County, all of Story County, for us partnering with our communities, all our communities, especially a community where 70% of our tax revenue comes out of, but participating with our communities for the good of all of the county, I thought we missed on March 12th, and if we pass on this, I think we're missing a second chance.
Was that a motion?
It can be. I don't know that it's. I mean, I'm glad to make a motion. If you guys want to make a motion, I think I understand pretty clearly where we are. I hope you understand very clearly where I am. I'm in the same spot I was back on March 12th. I'm glad that we got clear that we can afford it. We may choose to prioritize it low enough that we don't want to afford it, but we can afford it. And now we make whatever decision we make.
Okay. There's one thing, and I have a question for Lisa Markley again. I think I already know the answer to it, but it will be helpful to have it out there. When you talked, when we talked earlier about TIF debt and the payments, you said that payments could be structured any way that we want. All right. Does that mean that then, say, we go zero, or let's say we issued bonds for $2 million with, would it be interest-only payments for, say, 3 or 4 years?
Could be. Probably not interest-only, but you can structure the payments so that they're lower, the payments are lower.
Mm-hmm.
We've structured all of those to ramp up as we collect more. So yes, it's totally acceptable to structure them however you want to structure them when you put it out for bid.
Okay. Because my thought here, and I'm just toying this with my head, and I'm sorry, y'all are going to have to watch my little abacus click for a couple minutes here, is how we keep our commitment, I feel it's commitment, with the policy of 50, keep money flowing to the small communities for economic development, but take advantage of when in fiscal year 22, which is when more debt, more TIF comes open, to be able to look at payments then. And but we still have to make some payment, is what I'm hearing from you. So in the couple of years where we still have lower, because fiscal year 22 kicks back up to, we expect revenues to go back up to about $500,000.
But our first payment doesn't occur till then.
Right. Okay.
There's...
What are you saying, Lisa?
The odds are the first payment wouldn't be until 22.
Right.
You wouldn't
and
be able
so
to
we don't even have to worry about those lower amounts.
Well...
the lower revenues then. Okay.
Again, whether you guys want to do this or not, we can, if it's a priority, we can afford to do it. If you still want to vote no, that's fine, vote no or no vote or however you want to structure this, Loris. But it, I was not comfortable when we came out of here a couple weeks ago that the argument was we just flat out can't afford it when we clearly can.
I'm sorry, because I thought I was going to vote one way here. And the next question I have, Lisa, is, I'm so sorry. All right. We looked, your payment structure is at a 10-year. All right. But what is the long, we can go 20 years. No, you don't want to go 20 years?
So we stop having the ability after 20 years to keep the increment. So
correct.
The magic number is 2032 is where I start to get uncomfortable. If you want to look at projections, after 2032, unless we're adding new properties, then it gets more problematic.
Yeah, because we lose the big chunk of turbine money, the initial ones. That's when we lose the majority of our income for that. And that concerns me because we could be putting it in to the community. I'm looking for the piece of paper that was sent. What is the payment on the tenure schedule? Somebody got it?
Yeah. At 4%, they're calculating that it would be $203,000 a year for 10 years.
Okay, and the projection on the revenue is that we would go ahead and still have over $250,000 and $350,000 a year left within that time period. I make the motion that we approve the $2 million with the $100,000 a year of the subsidy.
Second. So now we need to talk about the $100,000 a year, I think, because those are general fund dollars. I think it was Linda who pointed out a couple weeks ago that is asking, I mean, so that's money that you're going to spend every year. Again, I would be much more comfortable if that were part of a deficit rather than just a fixed fee every single year, because that's the intent of this. The intent of this is to understand that this place is probably going to operate at a deficit for X number of years, maybe in perpetuity, and what we talked through on March 12th, and leading up to that is I would much rather be a participant at some level of a deficit which can go down, capped at a certain amount and can go down, than I would just saying we're going to pay $100,000 plus 3% on top of that every year.
You seconded the motion, and now you're asking to amend it.
I seconded the motion so we could talk about it. Once you made the motion, I seconded it so we could talk about it. I said that before there was ever a motion made, that's where I was.
Yes, you did. Yes, you did. I have the comfort at the $100,000. Seems like six, 8 weeks ago was the first set of numbers I was moving around in my head. I thought $100,000 was more in keeping with what would be realistic. Okay. I don't think the 3% increase per year is bad considering inflation. 165, I know, wants to limit us. I know. So I'm okay with where we are. The deficit, if I'm hearing correctly, you want to put a cap on how much so that we don't have to pay the $100,000 once the deficit goes away, if it goes away, right?
So I can't figure out why. So if there's not a deficit, I can't figure out why we would be contributing on an annual basis. If the place is self-sufficient, and now, maybe they want to tie that to Story County residents outside of Ames having access to the membership, but I felt like this was, at least conceptually, was something we talked about a lot on the 12th. Mm-hmm. I felt, and I looked to Nancy, I felt like we had agreement on the 12th when it was $200,000 that was going to be a cap and it was going to fluctuate at 30% of whatever the deficit was. And maybe this is an entirely new animal since it's half of that.
No, I'd say we're still staying in the flavor of what was being asked. It's just that when we went now to 50% less, we still have to be looking at what was that incremental increase annually for the 25% reduction. So we really tried to tie it to, even if we're breaking even operationally, we would love to make that happen, which will be a stretch. We still believe we're trying now to tie it back for data and equity to what's fair, and that's what we believe is a fair number. And again, I appreciate your support in that work, because that's where it's at, Rick, in that 25% that we would have been getting. We'd still be losing that from a revenue perspective.
Any further comments? Okay. I'm going to call the vote. Olson, aye. I've made the motion.
No.
Aye.
Okay. There is a $2 million commitment, $100,000 a year, all right? And we will direct or ask financially for the auditor department to put together some options for a loan payment schedule.
Thank you.
Yes. I thank everybody who has sat through these meetings. And once again, everyone who's been able to put together and read through them together, and all of us who reprint numbers also. And I, my heart tells me that I made a good decision. My head and my stomach are twirling right now. Okay. So, thank you very much. Let's move on. I can bring my computer back up. All right. Next is insurance discussion. And this is discussion and consideration of 2019-2020 Wellmark Health Insurance Contribution Rate. Hello, Alyssa. Welcome back.
What you see in front of you would be the employee and employer contribution rates for the next fiscal year for our health insurance. I apologize, I can't talk very well this morning, but just to kind of outline and have a little discussion on this, I have recommended there are two contribution changes. We have two public safety contracts, and in their contracts, the contribution changes, it triggered the change in employee contributions if the increase in the premiums were greater than 20%. And we had two plans that were greater than 20%. That would be the single in the $500,000 deductible under the Alliance Select plan. Those increases from last year's actuarial-based premium was a little over 24%. So I have recommended that we do change those to be consistent. So the countywide, we have the same contribution rates for all employees, whether they're covered in those two bargaining units or they're not covered in those two bargaining units. Mm-hmm. And I do want to note that it's kind of confusing when we partial self-fund. What we pay Walmart is different than what the actuarial base for the plan that we offer our employees, because we partial self-fund down the deductible and the out-of-pocket max on all the plans.
Okay.
So.
Questions?
Any questions? No?
Alyssa, I know you did a whole lot of work on this, and I really, really appreciate it. If there's no other questions from anybody, I'll move the adoption of the 2019-2020 insurance contribution rates.
Second.
All right. Further discussion? No. Murphy?
Yes.
Sanders?
Aye.
Olson, aye. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. I'm going to ask for a little indulgence here and ask if we can move around the Ames Urban Fringe Plan letter, as it's identified here, and move it in front of secondary roads, if that would work for Darren Moon. And the reason is, I know we've got three members of the audience out here who I think are here for that particular issue, and they've sat through. Darren, you good with that? Okay, thank you. So I'd like to move down now to item 5. And Jerry, sorry about that. I know I threw you off, but I just, they've been sitting there so patiently watching government work. So, welcome, Jerry Moore.
Thank you. At the last board meeting, the board directed staff to work with Supervisor Olson in crafting a letter that addressed the memo that we provided at the 19th Board Supervisors meeting, which references the meeting that we had with RDG, the consultants who are working on the Ames Comprehensive Plan. And so the focus of the letter that's before you addresses the importance of working with the City of Ames and Gilbert on as partners with the comprehensive plan and the 2080 agreement. The bullet points, for the most part, are consistent with what was addressed in the previous memo that we prepared. And I think the point that staff would like to make is these are, it's not intended to be a complete or an exhaustive list. The most important point of this is, with this letter, is that we want to encourage our partners, Ames and Gilbert, to consider extending the Ames and Friends plan and the agreement, because it will expire in 2021 if it does not get renewed. So that's the primary focus. And if, and hopefully it does, it gets extended, this will just be a starting point of many, many issues that will be discussed with regard to the land use planning. I have been in contact with a couple of citizens who saw some of the information that was made available at the last meeting. Mr. Christensen is here. I think there's some other folks who are also interested in this issue, and I think they're planning on speaking. But I'll just highlight a couple of the main points that Mr. Christensen raised in his letter. He resides in the southwest portion of Ames. It was part of the Southwest Growth area. There hasn't been a lot of activity in that location, but the concern that he raises really has everything to do with how that area is designated, which is urban residential. These areas are supposed to be prime for annexation. They're supposed to be targeted for growth. And so if you're actually planning to do a development in that location, if you were to annex and develop under the city standards, that's the primary purpose of that urban residential designation. And he just points out that with that, you're not able to do like smaller rural type developments. And that is a concern to him. He also points out that a lot of the land in that location is owned by the Iowa State University. It actually comes up with a possible news designation that would buffer the rural land uses with more of the urban land uses. And again, I think Mr. Christensen is planning on speaking, so I'll let him finish up there. Also had another email who also communicated with Supervisor Merkin. She lives on the northwest side of Ames in the Ames Urban Fringe. Very concerned about traffic in that area, particularly along Cameron School Road. She's indicating that not only are motorists using it to get from Ames to Boone County, a lot of trucking companies are using that as a route, and that's something that's disturbing to her. And she suggests that we look at east-west road improvements, particularly along 180th, referencing the bridge that was closed, that should be reopened or redesigned to allow traffic, and then that the road be extended to 500th Avenue to allow for a complete east-west route. So I just wanted to mention her concerns as well. And I think that's primarily what I wanted to cover. Again, the letter is intended to get their attention and to let them know that the county, that the board supports the Ames Urban Fringe Plan. We support the extension of the 2080 agreement, and these bullet points are really just a starting point for hopefully meaningful discussion. And when this gets open, there's going to be a lot of time for public input, which is essential for good, effective planning.
I think that's very well put. Thank you. And actually, thank you to the staff who wrote the report and then used the report to write this letter. I really was impressed with what I wrote. That being facetious, it'll be my signature on it. But you guys did a great job. Thank you for that. And I see the three residents here and give them an opportunity to come up and speak. You will have many, many chances. We haven't started discussions yet. So I didn't get cards from anyone, but Kim, Mr. Christensen, if you want to come on up first, and if you feel okay, so we'll just have you come up one at a time, all right? Sure. And you'll need to give the card to look from.
I'll take
the card. Lucy will take the card. That works out just fine. Good morning.
Okay, thank you. Kim Christensen. I live at 2985 South Dakota Avenue. I guess it's probably not very easy to put up the handout, but did you all get my handout?
Yes.
Showing the 3,000 acres that Iowa State owns in the southwest part of Washington.
Thank you.
My concern, or my thought, of course, is that certainly the classification needs to be changed. Back in the day, you know, it was thought that Iowa State would give up this land, it would all be developed in a massive city of Ames, would be in the southwest. They developed the interchange for that particular situation. And that hasn't come to fruition, and I don't believe it's going to. Since then, Iowa State has acquired even more property. They've expanded their farms, a dairy farm. Now they're talking about swine farm, poultry, the feed mill, all in that area. We have a little bit of land south of the 30 and north of the Iowa State main part of land that is still in the county, still possibly could be controlled in the county, that I would love to see become a buffer that we use to try to maintain the environmental integrity of the World Creek area, as well as create the lifestyle that's been there. We're all in the agricultural kind of rural living standard, and all the development that's been done there from Meadow Glen all the way to Valentine Hill, we're all in the agricultural area and understand farming and the smells and all the different things that happen in farming. We're perfect for buffer. There are two main areas that could be developed, both the Doug McKay property and the Champlin property. Probably would be happy if they were allowed to develop rural. So I would love to see our county control that. And if the reason I would love to have this in the letter now is that I think it's very important that the city understands early and why they're doing the 2040 plan, to just put one more bullet in there that just basically states that you're interested in developing a buffer in the southwest part of town between the city and Iowa State's development, agricultural development properties. So I'm not asking for very much, just an idea, another thought process. And it is different because it's actually going to allow some kind of rural development than the other three classifications allow. So,
Kim, how does your concept differ from the existing rural residential designation?
The rural residential really is discouraging any development. And
it's urban residential right now.
Oh, you mean the one that is right now?
No, the one that is right now, urban residential, that requires building the city standard.
Yeah.
But it seems to me, so we've done a couple county, environmentally sensitive subdivisions under the rural residential designation. And what I'm not clear on is, do we need a whole new designation, or are we simply saying, and I even think people within the city of Maine are saying this, that when the urban fringe plan was developed back in the late 90s, early 2000s, wasn't finally approved till I think 2011, but when it was developed almost 20 years ago, there was a very strong belief that Ames was going to grow southwest, and that belief doesn't exist anymore. I don't think there's people in the city of Ames who think it's going to truly grow out there. And so I'm seeing real movement to change the designation in a couple places, southwest, but also along North Dakota, further north from this, what is right now urban residential, back to the rural residential. And I think that accomplishes what you're asking for.
It does almost. I mean, and I possibly could live with that. But for all the property owners, the people that own large pieces of land, like the Doug McKay and the Champlins, it doesn't allow for really any kind of encouragement of rural development, building small, big lots, large lots, 5-acre lots. It's pretty, it states in the fringe plan that it's not really for development. If they don't, they don't want to encourage any kind of rural development. It should be, everything should be for agriculture. So I'm saying we need a buffer area that goes from the intense urban environment to the rural environment and allows that kind of development.
So I see it differently than that, Jerry. Can you help me?
My camera states, for example, that was designated rural
residential.
And that was developed fully under the county's regulations.
Right.
Compared to like the Iron, that was a transitional district. All three counties we do, but we primarily, Ames was the primary where they were.
Right. But under rural, it would allow for these larger lot kind of developments that I think Kim's talking about.
I think
it's kind of discouraging.
Well, you may be referring to ag farm service, because if you're in ag farm service,
no, not ag farm service.
Oh yeah, well, I would be much more tuned to ag farm service. The rural, I don't think it's right that we should be under the Ames infrastructure requirements to do development.
Yeah, rural residential doesn't require the infrastructure requirements. I think we're saying the exact same thing. We're just putting a different designation on it. So what I'm suggesting, Kim, is the different designations already exist, and what you're asking for is moving from urban residential to rural residential in an updated urban fringe plan.
For sure in the letter, let's go back to the letter, not necessarily bringing up a new designation in the letter, just put in that you have a concern for a buffer area between the city and the Iowa State property. That's really all I'm asking for at this meeting. If you would do that, then the city would realize that you're interested in creating a buffer, if you believe that.
Okay. One of my thoughts and concerns about starting to insert, well, I can insert that, is that right now the letter hits broad areas. And I can see, where you would fit under, we have to discuss the priority growth areas, for example, and the city of Ames had designated it as a Southwest as a priority growth area for a long time. But as you listed some of the obstacles, there were more obstacles, and Doug came up to try seven different ways to get that, kind of to developed, right? And so my concern is if we get one narrowing in, and I know it's just one suggestion, but then already, as we've heard from people, I'm concerned that every time we send a communication that we clear through the board first is going to end up being more and more specific for everyone. And so that's what I thought. I thought it's an interesting idea, and hadn't I heard of that somewhere before, kind of about the difference of the designations. But so that would be my hesitancy, is saying we've already got, 8 points or something here. And so I like your idea that I like that name better, the buffer area. I'm probably not inclined to add anything. I mean, despite my bad joke about did I write well, they did a good job and they kept those in broader areas that we know there's going to be lots of subgroup discussion.
Jerry did an excellent job for that.
Yes.
And it does infer that there is, that there's questions about the growth area and all of that. I just like the word democracy, so they knew that you're talking specifically.
I have just loved how your neighborhood has stepped up. I mean, the emails we were getting still later. So, anyway, Supervisor Murphy. Nothing.
Okay.
No.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you, Kim. Thank you.
Oh my. I was planning on that. As Kim walks away, I just want to say, in the urban fringe plan right now, there is something called the rural urban transition area.
And so I'll take the blue card.
And it's to accommodate rural development that can also be accommodated within the municipal jurisdiction at some point in time. And I believe the entire intent of that is, so that's more what we did with the Irons, right? That transition area, Gary.
Rural transitional.
But rural residential is intended to be built and stay in the county in perpetuity.
The rural transitional is supposed to be going into an urban area?
Eventually. rural-urban transition. Yeah.
That's what I don't want.
Exactly. But there is a rural area that is intended to never go in.
Well, we're talking about another issue, and we'll talk again later.
Okay, good. I was going to say, this is going to be a fascinating discussion. But so keeping focused on the letter, we've already wandered today a little bit here. Okay, so thank you. Yes, Phil.
Yes, I'm Phil Isevely. I live at 3108 South Dakota Avenue. It's R38. Right, our home is right in the Whirly Creek Valley, and we had the big go-around 2005-06 with the City of Ames wanting to put the sewer line through the drainage of Whirly Creek. In reviewing the present plan, urban fringe plan, it states several times over and over again the importance of the environment, retaining the environment, the ecosystems in the rural areas, and then particularly in Whirly Creek. And of course, Whirly Creek is right in the urban fringe area, and these properties that the McKay property and the Chaplin property are both in that southwest developed area that, as Kim said earlier, the city, you know, had targeted over, what is it now, 10, 15 years ago as a priority growth area. And we all know that has changed tremendously. And as was stated earlier as well, Iowa State owns a tremendous amount of ground out there just in Story County, let alone over into Boone County, all the way over to where United Community School is, the ag land, all that. So the prospects for residential development out in that area are pretty slim as far as developers are concerned. At this point, I would encourage that the board go ahead and endorse or send forward the letter with the concerns somewhere in there or down the road that a buffer is definitely necessary, and this is an opportunity for that, especially since Iowa State, as you know, has plans for a feed mill right there on State Avenue where the old University Farm Services used to be, and it's right adjacent to the Metal Glen area. That will happen as soon as they get the $20 million plus that they need. They already have a supporter. They're further down the road. The old Christian Swine unit, teaching farm, that's going to be renewed or rebuilt or whatever you want to call it. And then the poultry farm is slated to be replaced. That's just down the road from there. So in other words, right down State Avenue all the way down to I think it's 270th, I'm not sure which street it is, but anyway, where the dairy farm is now, Iowa State controls all that ground. Now, not necessarily Iowa State, of course, as you know, there's like four or five different entities. You've got CAD, you've got the Achievement, the Foundation, so on and so on, owns all different pieces of ground there, but yet it's all under control of Iowa State. But in the present plan, there are numerous references in their goals and to preserve the environment, to be knowledgeable and be aware of the agricultural practices that go on now, not only at Iowa State, but there are private farms there as well. There's the Bentley property, the Belmont property, Valentine property. These are all farms that all have, some of them have livestock, some of them don't. The Bentley property used to be a big dairy. It's no longer there. But anyway, regardless, the practices that occur on agricultural grounds, spreading manure, so on and so on, those will continue. Iowa State, with its farms along State Street, is no longer here, but it was clearly stated that when the development occurred to the east of the sheep farm, sheep were going to be out there. So don't complain when you smell. And no, you're not going to run the street all the way down to the dairy farm. That was another thing that the city wanted to do. Anyway, I would just encourage the board to really somehow convey to the city of Ames, basically, and in the urban fringe plan, that above at this time, and with the technology that we have today, it is important that a buffer is maintained in all the in the rural areas, because things like the Iowa State swine unit and beef teaching farms that are in the northwest part of Ames, that's going to impact, it already does, residents that live out there. Mm-hmm. So there is numerous areas that a buffer should be considered and maintained, because like when they were going to want to develop the area around Whirly Creek, that was their idea, the issue came up of, yeah, I want to be a resident sitting here and watch the people on the Iowa State Curtis farm out there in their little white uniforms with their little spray trucks spraying and go, what in the world are they spraying out there that those guys have respirators and all this stuff? So anyway, that's my point. Mm-hmm. Thank you very much for the time.
Thank you.
And thank you for the time and everything. I wrote down a couple of topics I wanted to bring up.
Thank you. Please introduce yourself.
Yes, Ken Beckrup. I'm at 2625 Meadow Pine Road. And I kind of came along to hear what they were saying. I think they covered it, but I did have a few other topics. I mean, as you heard, we kind of talked together about the change out there. And I, again, would encourage that to make that a rural buffer. You know, some of my things are is when I'm a little bit new to the area, I look through the environmental studies back in 2006. You read about it's just a change for the butterfly, that green snake and things that's kind of unique out there, the habitat. I was basically putting that butterfly farm right there when you come into Meadow Glen. So I like to see that buffer strip. You know, we have the Iowa State corridor out there, so we're going to have more of the semis coming in, the feed mill and everything. It really is seems like an agricultural division. So that's why I would like to encourage that. I guess the other thing is just from a safety standpoint, and I don't really have all the facts. I know it would be more discussion. But when things change, like we don't have fire hydrants and things out there, so we rely on Kelly's fire department. So because of the property tax and stuff in Washington Township, Ames is not able to service because they really don't have the trucks to get the water out there. So there is some concern of that we really fit the rural development more because the resources would be like firefighting equipment. So there are other concerns of safety I'd like to bring up. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Kim. Yes, thank you. Okay, comments to think about as we move ahead for stay on the letter?
Yeah, so I think I
okay.
Never mind, go ahead.
Comments? Or, okay.
I wanted to add something else.
Okay.
The person that spoke with Jerry was not able to be here today. She had planned to be here today, but she let me know she was not able to. When the memo that Lee received on March 14th talked about discussion at that meeting of transportation planning, the county transportation impact analysis ordinance, and three northern Ames urban fringe plan dangerous intersections. I didn't really see that issue dealt with very strongly in the letter that's been drafted. It talks about importance of transportation and metropolitan planning organization planning, but that's pretty general compared to what we're hearing about the problems there. And in fact, it was Rick who said those are the three most dangerous intersections in Story County in one of our budget work sessions, I believe, or later talking about the engineers. So I really think that rises to a level that we need to say a little bit more than just Oh, we need to talk about MDO planning. That's what. That's. And our traffic impact study.
I'll speak last.
I think that's.
So between the two of you. Okay.
Yeah, so I was simply going to start by saying I agree with what's been said here today, and now after Linda, I can still say I agree with what's been said. I just think for an initial letter where we're just beginning the conversation, what we've got here is completely sufficient and appropriate, and it allows us to have those more detailed conversations, which I tend to agree with, down the road, rather than if I struggle with it, we're going to start putting sub-bullets in. Where do you stop? Because the second you put one in and leave one out, you have... in a de facto way, said that this sub-item is more important than that sub-item, and I don't think we're there yet. And I think all this letter is intended to do is say, on broad strokes, these are the things we want to talk about, and they include transportation, and they include buffer areas, and they include taking a hard look at what the realities are on the ground, not what we thought they were going to be 20 years ago, but what they are today, and then tailoring the plan to fit those realities. And I believe this letter is the right starting point to have all those conversations.
May I reply?
Go ahead.
I can understand that because we could have a laundry list at this point. However, I also sometimes hear the Amherst fringe plan, we've got to keep it, we've got to keep it, it's done some things. There are also some things it has not done. And I don't want us going into this thinking Amherst fringe plan is perfect. Right now, please, because there are a lot of things in terms of planned and orderly development that I don't see out of it, and I think some other people don't see out of it. So maybe what I simply want to say is let's put a critical eye onto it. These two issues that we're talking about today and other issues where it needs to be improved.
So I have never heard anybody say that the Ames Urban Fringe Plan was perfect. And I got news, no matter what happens when it's redone, it's not going to be perfect.
It can
but
be better.
That's fine. It can be better. Everything can be better. But let's not let really good be the let's not let perfect be the enemy of really good. I mean, we are better today than we would have been if there was never an Ames Urban Fringe Plan. If all the people that have put the work in to get this original Ames Urban Fringe Plan put together, with its flaws, had not put it together, we would be in worse position today. And if we go down the road of getting hung up on a perfect document or what this document doesn't do or what the next one doesn't do, we're going to be throwing the baby out with the bathwater, and I think we need to go down the road of making sure that we're improving our community. I think this letter and this conversation is the right way to do that.
Okay. Jerry?
I think, again, the idea was that we would just do broad brushstroke, 10,000-mile view, and, again, the goal is that we should be communicating with Ames and Gilbert, our partners, that we think is very important to get back to the table, to start talking about these policies. This is just a starting point, and there's going to be 10 times the amount of issues that will be discussed, and it will be an open process, the general public will be involved.
On my list of upcoming to-dos down the road is to, I think, come back as the board has more initial instructions to staff about how they want to approach the city and Gilbert about this. I mean, we are just so early in the process, but I think that's what has to happen, that staff. This morning, just kind of on a side note, but it's about transportation and the MTPO, but Deb, Darren, and I met for about 10 minutes to discuss Cameron School Road and the discussions that are starting about either roundabout or traffic signal there. And I'm hoping that if this goes as planned, that with Deb and Darren taking the lead to the city, they'll come up with a format by the time they come back to us to start discussions on what we want. It won't be very far. They're just going to set up a framework that maybe we can use that then shifting over to the urban fringe plan as we get started. You know, so I just want to let you know about that. You're smiling here, okay, but that's that seems to be, they can develop some kind of model. No pressure on you, Darren. Okay? All right. So let's go back to the lab now. All right?
No problem. Go ahead. Do we need a motion?
I'm looking for a motion unless somebody has something
else. I move we submit the letter.
Yeah, I would second, and I just think you did a great job drafting the letter, Laura.
Thank you. You know, the brain power that actually went toward this was just wonderful. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good
job.
Yeah. Good job. Okay. Merkin.
Aye.
Ted Olson, aye. Go ahead, get the letter on my desk, and I'll sign it. And we're done with this topic. Please stay tuned for our discussions as we start to zone in and trying to get the hard work done. There are two people sitting in this audience right now who worked on that initial urban fringe plan. John Klaus, who was city attorney for a long time, and Leanne Harder with planning and zoning planning development. So we've got at least a good employee to start here to help rely upon, and we know where to make a little call if we need a little initial help. So we're going to move now to Darren Moon, and we're going to discuss the five-year plan. Good morning, Darren. Oh, yes, you guys don't have to stay anymore. Thank you.
We held a little over a month ago on the five-year program. I'm just going to touch on a couple things that have changed since then. I'll see if the board has any input or changes to move forward with the program. Project-wise, the funding side, though, did change a bit. We did move forward with the bonding proposal. These are the projects that were included in the bonding proposal. I would point out the third project there, the 560th Avenue. Our proposal for next year's local budget had $750,000 in there for this project. We bumped it up to a max of $1 million that we'd give to the city. But that will free up $750,000 out of our local budget. So that's one of the big benefits for me for bonding. We can put that towards more rock in the roads or towards some of these intersections we're talking about northwest of Ames. Beyond that, we've discussed these other bonding projects. We added the Timberland at the last meeting, drive project for that development up by Story City. On to our worksheet for our balances. This is our funds other than our local funds. In updating this form, we are able to remove all the bonding projects are now removed. This is without bonding. And we were able to move this S27. By removing the bonding projects, it created a lot more balance in our STP, which is our federal aid road money. So I moved a project that says 27 out of FM funds to the federal aid funds. That's really the only change I made there other than taking the bonding projects out. So you can see our ending balances here. We're all in the positive now at the end of 24. This will also open up some more discussion on adding more federal aid road projects into the future program.
Mm-hmm.
So moving on to the actual worksheets, like I said, not a lot of changes to the project. We added the Timberline Drive, the number 5 project, to this. Those first 3 stayed the same. 560th Avenue, that's the one, $1 million towards Huxley Cooperative Project, north of Highway 210. 220th is 13th Street paving extension. I did move that a year up. It was in 21. I moved it up to 2020. That's about the earliest we could actually let the project. When we get design and right-of-way purchase, so we'll let that next winter. E18, we bumped that into a bonding project. You can see the ones we have bonding are stated over on the right. And then lastly, 530th. University extension down to the Kelly pavement. I also bumped that up a year. It was in 2022. I bumped it up into 2021. Again, it's probably the earliest we could do it, but Bob Johnston mentioned we have a 3-year time limit to get that money spent. And by the time we let a project, it takes another year after that to actually spend the money. So we really have 2 years to develop the project in that one. So I moved that up a year. Beyond that, not much else changed with roads. Bridges, there was just one thing I wanted to comment on. This E18 bridge, that's one we applied for some federal grant funds on, and we were supposed to hear back in January, but I think the federal government shutdown affected that. We still have not heard a result, but the DOT said to go ahead and assume we're going to get that grant. That was just a couple days ago, so I bumped this, and they want us to plant it in 2020, so that bridge will be bumped into 2020, assuming we get the federal grant for that bridge. Other than that, I just denoted the 2 bonding projects on this form, but nothing else changed bridge-wise. I did want to comment, Lindy forwarded me that email on one request since our last meeting on possibly extending West 190th out to the County Line Road. Mm-hmm. I'll kind of explain some of the reasons why we went ahead with the bridge closure here. One reason is this whole area here is about 1,000-foot stretch floods and overtops the road, and it's done that again this last week, so everything's washed out again. So we're hoping to alleviate that problem, and the bridge had reached the end of its useful life, so we're looking at a $1 to $2 million bridge depending on the design, which would be difficult because it's in a detailed flood insurance study, so we could not back up any more water. So by raising that road, it would take a much longer bridge.
I understand the problem with that bridge and acquiring property. What I found interesting was after that I looked at this list and I saw you had 180th in your paving, basically from North Dakota to Highway 69. And there's a dandy bridge on 180th a little further west that's fairly new.
Yeah.
Just thinking about east-west, and that's our problem, is east-west roads that are paved.
Yep, that bridge really helped out the east-west connection, but the next step would be to pave it. But with the terrain, driving down 180th, it's very difficult terrain to pave to a paving standard, so that's the difficulty of that one would be the next step there. But that would be a great connection east-west. This one, let me zoom out a little bit. I would point out, too, that the other thing is this road, when it was paved, it wasn't brought up to a paving standard, so it's kind of a really rural residential design. It's down to 20-mile-an-hour speed limit. It was never intended to be through traffic, and this intersection right here is kind of blind both sides. So we really didn't want to increase traffic through that area for safety reasons.
Before you go on, Darren, also talk about the problems with extending 190th to the west, because one of the requests was replace the bridge, which is, you just pointed out, was problematic, but also going all the way west over to County Line Road. Not only now do we have a building built where the roadbed would be, but there were real terrain problems when you looked at that 5 or 6 years ago.
Correct. We did look at this, like I say, before we decided we could go forward with that, and determined costly, and that this wasn't ever meant to be a through road. And I don't know if paving that would take that much traffic off of Cameron School Road anyway. It may take a little. I don't know that would accomplish a lot.
Plus that, I don't know what year this picture comes from, but there's a seed company, a big red barn now that's built right there.
Right there.
It's north of the intersection. It's north of that T, Rick.
The building is just barely north, but the property is right there. I mean, the entire property is right there.
Yes. But this is something we can leave in for discussion. I just wanted to give a little background on why we went ahead with the bridge closure. This portion wouldn't be that big of an issue getting over to here and paving down, but again, that wouldn't really alleviate any traffic on Cameron School. And then the other thing, of course, is you discussed a little bit earlier, this intersection when we get over to here is built out more with the irons and everything, but that's the intersection we're talking about, meeting with Ames and discussing roundabout or signals.
Talk more about that in comments. Okay, the first. Thanks, Jeremy.
Any other questions on that? Beyond that, based on this discussion, I held off on printing a brand new map, but we'll print a new map, and 2 weeks from now is our last chance to get it approved by the April 15th deadline, so at that meeting I'll need to have a final proposal for you to sign off on.
All right, on that. Okay, great. Thank you.
No other changes for the program at all? Good.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. I think we're now ready to talk to IT. They've been sitting back there patiently. Barb Steinbeck and Kyle, come on up. We're going to discuss and consider the contract extension and redundancy upgrade between Story County and Arion for $6,442.51. And is that over a 3-year term, or is it the same amount for each of 3 years?
Good morning, Board.
Good morning.
This is a replacement, well, it's a renewal of our current contract, and that is per month. A little history, we originated with Light Edge, and our cost was close to $10,000 a month. So Arion bought the business from them 3 years ago and brought our cost way down. So,
did you say the $6,000 figure was per month?
Yes.
Okay. And that brought it down, is what you're saying?
Yes,
when the order.
Well, and currently what we're paying is about $7,500, depending on long distance.
Okay.
So when it came budget time and people were asking, you know, what do we budget for? I said, no increase, and it seemed kind of strange. We weren't given this until just recently, but they had promised us it would be a reduction. And what they've done, they've looked at their standard licensing versus premium licensing model and decided to offer the premium at the standard rate. So everyone has been moved to the standard rate, which brought it down almost $1,000 a month. It'll fluctuate a little bit depending on long distance. So that's the recurring charges. I'll let Kyle talk about the non-recurring charges, which I think you'll be happy to hear about, especially since we had an outage again last week. But the reason, and this contract does not renew until June, I wanted to bring it to you now so that they could start on the redundancy piece of us. They said as soon as this was signed, they would start digging. So I'll let Kyle talk about now the non-recurring charges, which will provide redundancy for us.
So
So currently, the brains of this phone system live down at the Ariane Data Center in Des Moines. And the outages that we've had have been the old Windstream connection. Windstream gets cut, the phones can't see the brain, they go down. So with this new redundancy plan they have, they'll put one brain here in Nevada, one brain in Ames, and utilize Ariane fiber, which is redundant itself, where Windstream isn't. And then if we have an issue with fiber here in Ames or here in Nevada, it'll fail over to the other brain in Ames and still be able to talk to the data center. And Ariane is going to be eating about $10,000 to $15,000 in build out to get us on their equipment.
Okay, that's good to hear that Ariane is going to pick this up,
yep,
so that we don't experience like we did before.
And they're probably anticipating, you know, more customers. That's why they're paying for the $10,000 build out over at the Justice Center. And so this will be on the Central Iowa broadband circuit, and then Ariane has INS fiber as well. So we'll completely be bypassing Windstream. And they've had issues, so this is good news for us. And they understand our pain. But we're not the only customers. I think the one we had in November, they had 17 customers that were down. So this is exciting for us that we would put the setup in HSC at that building and then another one at the Justice Center to provide full redundancy for us.
That is good news. Thank you. Barb, I just want to let you know, though, that Kyle and Joel, the two I interacted with during the outage, did a great job. I appreciate the customer response. The updates, even headed into Saturday morning, were great. So thank you. And Barb, thank you for answering your phone while you were in, was it Philadelphia? Or where were you, Pittsburgh or something? Yeah. Oh, San Diego. Oh, never mind. Wrong direction, but okay. But thank you for all of that. Okay.
So I guess then we're just looking for your approval.
Board, have a motion?
I move approval of the Ariane contract.
Second.
Sanders?
Aye.
Murphy?
Aye.
Olson? Aye. Thank you very much for that.
Yes. Thank you, Board.
All right. Now, Barb,
let's see.
You're going to give us your quarterly report.
I will try to make it as condensed as possible. The first thing I wanted to talk about, and something that we're all struggling with, is the email security. The spammers and hackers have been getting smarter, and they're starting to send us emails from people with Story County addresses, and we've been getting a lot of calls. Do I click on this? Do I not click on this? How do I know it's safe? So what Joel has done is, if you've noticed, now on the emails coming in from outside, even if it has a Story County address, if we know it's coming from outside the server, we'll stamp it with that external sender, please use caution. So that should help us a little bit in being able to identify those. People may choose to read those, but please don't click on any links if you're not sure of the sender. So we're not completely going to stop this, but we can fight it the best we can, and this is just the latest tool we've come up with to try to have people not click on those links, and we do have people click, unfortunately. I also wanted to just give an update on the camera project at the Sheriff's Office. We've brought that in-house. We've been working on it a while. This is new to us. We're leaving the vendor out of the equation and taking on the hardware and the software support, although we still have some support from Milestone, which is the software vendor. So right now, everything's been installed. The jail is testing it. And we're installing the client. We should have that done today, installing the new client on all the workstations. And if the testing goes well, then we will completely be on our own. So, and it's not new to the guys. They've helped out a lot with the support and the installation when we couldn't find or locate the vendor before. So this is just going to improve the service. AS400 replacement happened the first week in March. Frankly, it went a lot smoother than I thought it would, and I'm so happy that it did. We worked with Solutions. They're a great vendor. They know the AS400 inside and out. What we have now, we have the old system still up and running and the new system in place. The old system, at first we were going to upgrade the old system and then move everything to the new box. Unfortunately, the old system, which is 10 years old, was not able to accept the new version of the software. So now we have the old system running on the old version and the new system running on the new version. What the new system has also done, we've gotten rid of tape backups. We used to rotate those over. We have a safe at the sheriff's office. Now we have disk drives. Everything's moving toward drives. So far it's been great. We'll keep the old system up and running maybe 6 months in case we miss something. We don't think we have. There were some images that Solutions had a question on when we moved to TCM. The images were moved over, but they weren't sure if we still needed them or not, so they're still existing there. We've also completed the public meeting room audio and visual update.
And I just would like to mention maybe we could talk later about that. Yeah, but as far as you guys are concerned, all the equipment's in and everything, right?
Equipment's in. We're not on a daily basis wondering if the projector will boot up or not. There was some back and forth on the microphones. It was told we wanted it one way, and then we backpacked and wanted it the other way. So if you have some other changes you'd like to make, I'd welcome to talk with you later.
Okay. Maybe three of us. We'll just set an appointment up. Yeah. Okay.
We did a fiber upgrade here in Nevada. We had some issues with, as technology gets better and better, the videos that we're trying to download for the sheriff's office and county attorneys are just too large. We're taking 2 to 4 hours timing out. So we did upgrade to 1 gig here in Nevada. So far, that's helped with some of the downloads. We have some issues with the software that the city of Ames is using called WatchGuard. For some reason, it has an increased speed on those downloads. We have talked to the vendor. We've talked to the city of Ames. Nobody can seem to pinpoint the issue. What we're looking at now is perhaps it's a firewall configuration that we need to change. So we're still exploring that. But what this will, most users will not see this because our phones are not capable of handling 1 gig. And so to get around that, we've installed little tiny mini switches at the stations where we need to have that full 1 gig capacity. And that seemed to work really well. And there's like $30 per switch. So we've done that in several workstations. As we're replacing our phones, the new phones that come in will have the 1 gig capacity. So, and they are cheaper than when we bought them 6 years ago. Just wanted to thank you for approving the new staff member this morning at the board meeting. He will start tomorrow, so we'll be fully staffed. I'm excited about that. We have been kind of limping along since December when Paula retired. So we're excited to bring someone else on board, and he will be coming from MICA. He worked there for 15 years, so we're excited to have him. Just wanted to mention, the last couple of weeks, you've probably seen Kyle send out notifications about network maintenance. What we've been doing is replacing switches. We've got about 40 or more switches throughout the county. You can get a little more life out of a switch than you can out of a PC. We don't like to see them go much over 10 years old, so every year we replace a couple. And we've also replaced, to provide some redundancy for the 911 network, we've replaced one firewall with two, so that one can fail over in case there's an outage. Redundancy seems to be the key word in networking, and it didn't used to be such an issue, but as I said before, our software is requiring more, and our hardware is requiring more, and more the vendors are having us access their sources online. So this is all very important to keep upgraded and to keep modern. The VoIP improvements, we just talked about the Arion contract. I'm very excited that I think right now, when we went with Arion 3 years ago, I don't think they quite knew the business as well as they do now, and that's why they're able to offer such good, to revamp what the standard and the premium licenses were, but also I've noticed our service is much more reactive, and they have the answers without having to call us back all the time, which we had before. So I'm really happy with the direction, and I'm glad that Arion is our vendor. The only other thing I just wanted to update you on was last week I was in San Antonio for the Central Square Conference. First time I've been to a conference. And our main concern was our 911 public safety software has recently been acquired by Central Square. And all the competition was telling us, oh, you need to hurry up and figure out what you're going to do because they're going to quit supporting you. Central Square specializes more in the financial packages and not necessarily public safety. So we had the first day we had a special meeting with a Central Square representative, and she assured us that they were going to continue to support our product, and they had a lot of new enhancements in mind. And I made sure, and I had asked the sheriff's office, do you guys have anything you want me to talk about? So Micah had wanted me to talk about the jail product. So the current one, the JMS product, does not really meet their needs, and that's why they have done some specialized jail software programming. So I did make sure that that was part of the conversation, and so the lady gave me a name to call, and she said she would set up a meeting sometime in the next week or two so that we could give them what our needs are now so that as in the future, as they're starting to develop and revamp some of the programs, that they'll have our needs in mind. So I was encouraged by that. I had planned to go to all the Zerker demos, and I went to a couple. So I do know what the other software looks like in case we do have to move. But they assured us that if they did decide to drop support and drop maintenance on our software, we'd be given at least a 5 to 7 year window. So that was comforting and reassuring, and it made the rest of the conference less tense. That's all I have. Do you have any questions for me?
No, thank you.
You're welcome.
Okay. Thanks, Barb.
Have a good rest of your day.
Yeah, thank you. It's now public forum number two. Ted, I apologize. Okay. Your room's next week. I'll get new glasses. Another new pair. Bye-bye, dear. Thank you. Good morning, Treasurer Ted Rasmussen.
Good afternoon, Board.
Treasurer
Ted Rasmussen, I am providing a report to you today of the alteration of the treasurer's office hours where we're open to the public. Going forward, effective April 9th of next month, the treasurer's office will be opening at 9:30 every second Tuesday of each month. This will be used for staff communication, development, and training time. With the changeover in leadership in the office, we want to take some time to review our internal policies and procedures and just work through communication plans with the group. We also have a lot of county processes and procedures, such as our emergency management plans, our COOP-COG, the way we work with other departments that we want to review and work better through to ensure that the county can work together as efficiently as possible. We feel that this monthly opportunity will really give us a chance to educate and improve our staff capabilities to serve the public. We have an intensive communication plan. You will see lots of signs around the building, updated frequently with all of our new hours posted. We have already updated our website, and we'll be updating both the Story County website and the iowatreasurers.org website. We'll change outgoing voicemail messages, and working with our special projects manager, Leanne Harder, on including this in her, I believe it's monthly spot on the radio, over names to kind of a continuous update of that. And we will be sending out a press release to all of the local media outlets with the updated hours, and we also will include information in the Our Story newsletter. We want to make sure that we serve the public as best we can. We know that this alteration in the hours may disrupt some people's schedules, so we want to be as proactive as possible to alert everybody of this. But we really feel like with the constant changes that government is going through, that this
this allows us to really educate our staff and be as efficient as possible moving forward. So wanted to bring this up at the board meeting to just provide one more opportunity to communicate to the public that this is what our plan is moving forward. You guys have any questions?
Good plan.
Yep. All right. Thank you, guys.
Okay. Thanks, thank you. Now we'll go to public forum number two. Oh, we flipped that around too, didn't we? Okay, thank you. I should actually read. All right, upcoming agenda items. Supervisor Merkin.
None.
Supervisor Sanders.
Nope.
All right. Well, I guess looked at kind of what was upcoming here as far as what I've been told about so far. Either on April 5th or 12th, we'll be having a discussion about the Story County Housing Trust Fund, funding for that as we move forward, and a new contract. And then on also April 12th, talking about the Cameron School Roads and George Washington Carver intersection.
I'm sorry, yes. April, so those are Fridays. Do you
The second and the ninth? I did, yes, thank you.
Yeah.
Okay.
So what day are you looking at? The second?
The second or the ninth. Thank you for that. Okay. So then April, and April 9th then for that discussion. And it's an initial discussion. I know both of you expressed some interest in working on it, or I could kind of keep it, and I decided that it would be a good learning experience for me and a chance for the staff, since that we've never worked on an arrangement where we would participate with Ames in what might be a developer's agreement or might be some other way. I'm just saying we're going to look at all the options here. I talked to Bob Kindred over at the city. He said this is usually how the city would do it if the developer was paying all the money, and that's one option for it going forward. But what Darren and Deb are going to do over the next couple of weeks is really gather information and find out what is the expectation from us. I've already talked to the developer. I know the developer would like some kind of possible financial interest here. We haven't made that decision, so what Deb and Darren are going to do is gather information about the groundwork of what might be involved here, and bring it back here to the board. Then it's anticipated that the board, we would have a discussion if we're interested in providing money related to this. There's going to be ground acquisition, the developer thinks, and I just, you know, this is a first, according to Darren, for us in this situation. Now, Rick, you're shaking your head no.
Yes.
What do you think is different or the same?
Yeah, so maybe it's a first. If we go down the road that you just suggested, it would be a first. Very possibly, and we're doing this with 560th in partnership with Huxley.
Right.
The county has done this repeatedly through the years, where we have ground that either is partially or getting ready to be partially controlled by a municipality and the county, and the municipality generally runs the project, much like Huxley is doing with 560th, and the county is a funder of its portion of whatever that project is, or we negotiate
right.
What kind of funder. And so this idea that this is brand new or something that the county has not done many, many times over the last 100 years, I think is a misnomer. I think it's great for you to get in the middle of it. I get concerned when we start talking about that we're going to reinvent the wheel. I mean, we've done this again and again and again.
And when Darren and Deb and I talked this morning, my understanding of what maybe the developer wants from us is to go beyond. Of course, Darren has often worked with, you know, part of, we're paying one
right.
half, we're paying one half. The issue seems to be, at least presented to me initially, is that we control, as in Story County, the land of three of the corners are
right.
in Story County. And so then how is that part even divided up? And who pays for half of the roundabout?
or the traffic light, because that's the study's recommendation. And do we as a board say we're not paying for a roundabout, we're not going to pay for land acquisition, developer, you're on your own? Or are we looking at coming in and paying for something? So, it's very clear that if we're going to do the standard, there's this two corners that needs a third lane, that's the recommendation, that there will be a L, if you will, and there'll be new land for a third lane. And so I described all of this morning, and Darren thought this was new territory for us. If it's not new territory, then let's have Darren and Deb find out everything, find out what's really going on, and come back to us. And then we can proceed. We can give instructions.
Yeah, I think that's perfect.
Okay.
Where it's new territory, Loris, is if the county is going to insert itself in the developer's conversation
right,
with
correct.
The city,
correct.
Then it's entirely new territory.
Correct.
That's not what we've done in the past.
Right.
What we've done in the past is we've worked with municipalities who have part of an intersection or a roadway or both
right.
that they want to do something with, and part of it's in the county, and we worked with them and negotiated what our role is. Our role could be, so we're talking about doing this with Nevada as we bring 13th Street all the way across,
correct.
Except we're going to run the project.
Correct.
Right?
Correct.
And Huxley's going to run
correct.
The project.
Correct.
And so we've got all these different ways of doing it, and what I'm hearing and what I would assume Darren is suggesting would be brand new is if we're inserting the county into the developer's agreement with the municipality, that's new territory.
That's
where I'm comfortable.
That's what I got from the conversation with the developer. Now, if I misunderstood the conversation, I think that's great for all of us.
Yeah.
But the fact that the developer has an expectation of us coming in, I mean, you said financially, you guys have three of the corners, so I think you should be, you know, invested in this. And, of course, my response back was, well, and we mentioned this morning, we don't even know how long we're going to have control of this. I mean, this is really an annexation. And the developer wants to start building right away. So based upon the information I got from Bob Kinders about how it normally works with just the city, signally, that's why I asked Deb and Darren to make more phone calls, to find more information, and then come back to us as a board and determine what they think the parameters of this are going to be, and then let us talk about what directions we want to give back to them. I guess it's my feeling for me to sit into a technical meeting about the creation of a roundabout versus a traffic light really is not going to contribute much. We're the funders and we'll set the parameters.
So if that's what we are, then we do that all the time.
Yeah.
And that's
so,
perfect.
But,
yep.
Okay. So that's what I've done is ask staff to come back to us. So back to, I believe we're looking at it's this April 9th for that. Right? And then April 23rd, you are planning to come with StoryCom?
Yeah, so appreciate that. Yes, we seem to be moving ahead with StoryCom really, really well. I think by April 23rd, and I think it goes to City Council that night as well, we'll be able to give a full update and pretty solid accounting of what's happening with the portion of the $3 million that we designated. There will be a portion of that, a large portion of that will go toward the build-out of the backbone. That will also affirm for us what we expect to have available for the purchase of radios, which will be each individual entity. And so I'm looking forward to that conversation.
Okay. And then the Watershed group is going to present their update. I had that for April 16th. You're looking at me.
We might
like
be able to do it on the 9th, but let's leave it on the 16th for now.
Okay. So anyway, that's what I've been told is coming up for agenda items so that there is additional time for preparation, gathering information. Okay? So thank you for that.
still don't have anybody from the public here. Third time's the charm, Robbie. Okay. Right. Thank you. And then other liaison assignments, committee updates, announcements.
We don't have anything this week.
Okay.
Yeah, so I'm excited about a meeting that I've got tomorrow talking about a concept of an anaerobic digester specifically for pig manure. There's a project like that that actually deals with dairy cows up in Wisconsin, and so it will be another one of those meetings where it won't take long to figure out who's got the least brain power in the room. It will be with a bunch of academics from Iowa State who will be educating me on these kind of things and what the possibilities are for our area and what, if anything, might be worth Story County taking a look at. So I'm excited to get through that meeting and see what if anything, comes out of it.
Okay. It's interesting, some of the topics that we get involved with. So I just wanted to quickly recap the meeting of the conference board for the assessor. The minutes have now gone out. The draft of the minutes have gone out. And all of the board members should have received, and when I say board members, I mean the conference board members should have received the minutes. And I just wanted to kind of reiterate that, or point out that a couple of the mayors had asked for there to be some investigation into how we pay the salary, the job description, and the how we set the compensation. And those people who turned up for the assessor's conference board decided to not go forward with paying for a compensation study. They also, a couple of mayors had brought up the need to have us check out and see if we should start assessing or doing evaluations and inspections more often. And it turned out, based upon information the assessor had brought to the table that night, that Story County was about as good, performing as well or better than the surrounding counties. And Ames doesn't really do it with the door-to-door inspection type anymore. So those people were present. We did have a quorum of the different entities, decided not to go to ISU and pay for a study. Thank you, though, Linda Merkin, because she went ahead and found someone at ISU to be able to take that study on should they vote to do that, but they didn't. So we also found out that the mini board does not officially exist. And as far as we can tell, it was never formed. First time it shows up, we're in the minutes of 1988, and they gave a report, and they give a report every year, but there's no evidence it was ever officially formed. It's not in Iowa code. So that the group that night officially declared no need for it. So the Story County mini conference board does no longer exist. And the proposed levy for the assessor is 47 cents per thousand. I met with the publisher of the Tribune. I have told him that we would like to look at a reduced price based upon Leanne Harder's request. I also asked him to price out twice a year.
This is for the Sun?
For the Sun, sorry. Tribune's publisher, because the Tribune owns the Sun. Right? He's supposed to get back to me within a couple weeks. Just wanted to let you know I did carry that forward. He said he'd look at the numbers. I don't know what we're going to come back, but we'll have that discussion at the board table then. And that takes care of kind of the highlights here, kind of boring business, but at the same time for follow-up. With that, I will take a motion for adjournment.
So moved.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Thank you. Okay.